Welcome to the Liminal Forest podcast, a series of walks and talks where I go and meet the creative minds and thinkers behind some of the most interesting projects helping us restore balance with nature. Today, I'm off to meet Daniel Raven Ellison, the founder of the Slow Ways Walking Network and also the brains behind National Park City. Daniel is down in Exeter, and so I headed down to meet him. And there we took a train down to a little village called Topsham, where we started our walk. So, here we are on a gloriously sunny Monday lunchtime, and we're in Topsham, which is a couple of miles south of Exeter. And I'm here with Dan Raven Ellison, who's very kindly offered to take me on a walk that I think is part of the Slow Ways routes. Dan, tell me why we're here and what are we looking at the moment?
So we're in Topsham, which is a very, very, very old village. People were building ships here hundreds of years ago. It was one of the most important shipbuilding sort of communities for a long time. And we're on Topex, which is one of the Slow Ways walking routes connecting Topsham to Exeter, the city where I live. And we're currently stood on the banks of the Ex, part of the Ex estuary. And we're looking out across some very large reed beds. And going atop of the reed beds is a rather glamorous M5. And to my back is suburbia. And we're just going to follow the river slowly upwards towards Exeter, going upriver.
So yeah, Dan, just tell me how you got into doing what you're doing.
Well, I used to be a geography teacher, and I think geography is an extremely important lens for making sense of who we are, our place in the world, and then how I guess we're connected to some of the biggest challenges we face in the world at the moment. Both challenges for us as individuals, just trying to navigate the world, but also these big societal and environmental challenges we face as well. And so I've always been very interested in how we can use geography and storytelling and adventure as a way to better understand how we can tackle some of these challenges, but also how we can enjoy ourselves at the same time quite often as well. And so a lot of my projects spin off that.
After about 10 minutes walking, the path we were taking got noticeably smaller and actually started hugging the riverbank of the Ex. It was muddy underfoot. Dan negotiated it with aplomb, whereas I squelched and slid left, right and centre, hoping to keep my balance and not fall flat on my face into the mud marshes. Then, there above us, we came across a huge motorway, the M5. Dan, we're walking along here and we've got the M5, and people would have done this for centuries, wouldn't they?
I think people have probably been walking along the X looking for food for thousands of years, I should think. And actually, I think the juxtaposition of the M5, you know, some people might think that it somehow detracts in this environment, but I think it only highlights that history further and adds a bit of additional perspective to it. So I think the M5 adds to our journey to some extent somehow.
We're truly at a crossroads at the moment. And we have the M5 in our rear now. We can't hear it so much. We can still see some cars, a steady stream going over. But we're in a lovely little path here, full of reeds. And just describe what we're seeing and where we are.
Well, we're further down the route now. And I don't know if the mic will pick up on it, but we're in this beautiful reed bed with the wind hitting along the top of the reeds, causing a commotion of a wave every few seconds as the sort of reed beds sort of clash together. And there's a beautiful sort of silveriness of them all, both in terms of the reeds themselves, but also the seed heads as well, like gorgeous silver colours.
Yeah, it really is quite impressive and just kind of amazing how you just have to walk just a little bit off the beaten track and you're in the middle of nowhere. Dan, we were talking, I mean, you had those years that you were working as a geography teacher, and that informed some of the thinking that have moved on to some of the other projects that we're going to talk to. Just tell us, when you left, finished as a geography teacher, kind of what was inspiring you and what were you trying to achieve?
Well, you know, I think a big reason why I became a geography teacher was because I wanted to work with people around various different social and environmental challenges we face in the world. And while working in a school with young people was absolutely brilliant work, I became fascinated by a school of thinking that I sort of developed with some colleagues around guerrilla geography.
And guerrilla geography?
Guerrilla geography.
And not, I love it. What is it?
It's not the study of guerrillas, although that could be involved. Guerrilla geography is radical, alternative, surprising, extraordinary geographies that I think are often very fascinating. And many people will be familiar with the idea of guerrilla gardening or guerrilla art, which is where artists or gardeners, you know, bring us delight or challenge us to think differently about places, often by taking things out of place and putting them somewhere new to help us make new neurological, emotional, cultural, political connections in our minds. And many people will be aware of Banksy, who is a street artist who will replace a grenade in someone's hand for some flowers, for example, this kind of thing. And it just gets you thinking differently. And so many of my projects now are using the same ideas, same thinking around taking things out of place to make new connections so that we can see the world in new or different ways.
Now, Dan, does that mean that, is that going traveling all around the world to really exciting new places all the time? Or is it more a philosophy of what you can do around here?
It's definitely, it could be completely either, but it's definitely a lot of it is about being rooted in where you are as well. I mean, one of the first big projects that I worked on with the Geography Collective, which was a group of artists, academics, therapists, a range of people from different sort of fields of thinking, was a project called Mission Explore with a group called the Geography Collective. And what we would do is create books and websites with provocative challenges to get children and adults to explore and see the world differently. So things like, for example, seeing who can photograph the most beautiful poo, which was accompanied by an incredible illustration of a giant chocolate ice cream, for example. Or seeing who can investigate the murder of an animal, both sort of challenging our ideas around whether or not an animal can be murdered, what is in fact an animal as well, but then also thinking about the science and geography behind where you might work out, you know, who decapitated that chicken, as an example. And then other sort of quirky challenges like, you know, can you cross Trafalgar Square without getting a single bird into a flap? And these are all things that are super fun to do as children and as adults that are deeply rooted in geography and place, but also get us thinking differently about the world as well.
And how are you challenging? What is the challenge you're asking, whether it be a kid or an adult, when you're thinking about things like that? How are you trying to get them to think differently?
Well, you know, it depends on the issue, but I think that quite often we see these sort of rather perverse things in our society that by thinking differently about them helps us to confront those issues. So one of the most radical pieces of guerrilla geography that I was involved in very early in the days of the School of Thinking was with a couple of academics where we went out outside the US Embassy in central London. And at the time, you know, George Bush Jr. was saying that waterboarding was completely fine. It wasn't torture, it was completely fine. Don't worry about it, nothing to see here. So we went to the US Embassy and held an international waterboarding championships outside the US Embassy by a sign that coincidentally said no ball games. And what we were doing is we were taking this thing that was done in secret spaces, but allegedly public and okay, and putting it into an overtly public place and saying, right, how do you feel about this? And actually, it was interesting that some of the Christian media in the US took the photographs and did some quite big pieces on the fact that this artistic practice we were doing was being carried out. So I think that whether it's investigating the murder of an animal or whether it's challenging torture, by recognizing that it's there and thinking differently about it, you can begin, I think, to sometimes make progress on some of these issues.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because a bit of what you're talking about there is geography as space and things that happen in a certain space that maybe are associated with it or are accepted. When you take it out and you put it in another space, you're asking people to look at it from a different point of view and challenge maybe kind of what has been accepted thinking in that way.
That's completely spot on. I mean, I think everything happens somewhere. And the challenge is to understand your perspective on that thing and your place and your role with those things so that you can hopefully make progress on those issues, whatever they are, is the way that I see it. So geography is extraordinarily powerful. And, you know, there's lots of talk at the moment about, for example, in the curriculum, having a natural history GCSE to help children become more connected with nature. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. You know, by all means, have those kinds of things. But I also think that geography in schools should be far more on point about, for example, you know, if we're talking about racism in society, yeah, by all means, history should go and do a good job of that. But actually, what's happening in terms of racism right now in our society, right now in our communities, and what's happening with culture wars is partially about the history, yes, but it's inherently about our geographies and how we relate to others right now and in the future too.
We walked a short distance further up the River Exe, and the conversation turned to Dan's new project, Slowways.
You know, one of the reasons, apart from wanting to meet you anyway and learn more about you and the work you've done, but one of the big projects you're involved in at the moment that frankly has really captured the public's imagination is Slowways. For those people who don't know about it, just explain what Slowways is.
So in this country, we're very fortunate to have a national road network. That national road network is easy to find your way around. It's reasonably direct, safe, well signed. There's incredible technology that can help you to move around very easily within it. We also have a national rail network with timetables and incredible infrastructure helping you to get from A to B. And we have the starting makings of a partially satisfactory national cycle network, which unfortunately is still mostly on roads, which we know isn't particularly safe. And then rather incredibly, for thousands of years, we've actually had a national walking network. But that national walking network has, in our politics, our culture, in all kinds of ways, been neglected. So if I asked you if there was a direct, safe, off-road accessible way to get between, say, Beaconsfield and Slough, or Huddersfield and Cardiff, we all know that searching that on Google at the moment, for example, is probably not going to give you a delightful experience, is it?
No, and neither going through kind of OS maps either. And the reality is of having walked so many miles through Wales, even on what you think of for public footpaths or rights of way, is that quite often you grind to a halt or you find yourself stuck up a mountain with nowhere to go. So I can completely... And yet, of course, you know, there were ancient drovers' routes. There were ancient walking routes all over the hills that have been there, as you say, for millennia. So tell us how you came about your idea and what's going on with it.
Well, so part of the problems we're raising there is some of that's about landscape and whether or not there is actually a path that you can follow and the quality of that path. We've actually just transitioned from a cobble path to a tarmac path, which is far more accessible. And then the other issue is about whether or not you have the mapping available to you. And then when actually the culture is there, that means that you might even find it desirable to think to walk from one place to another. So there's a whole range of ingredients around this. So Slowways is the ambition of creating a national walking network, and it's sort of founded by this sort of key idea that we should all be able to walk reasonably, directly, safely, enjoyably, off-road, accessibly, legally, between any two neighbouring places. And if you can't make that journey on foot or by wheel, safely, easily, directly, then I think given the health, the climate, the social, the economic crises, something is going wrong. Because if you want to walk to the next village or town to go and do your shopping or see a friend or go to a funeral, or whether you want to go to the next town to then link up lots of routes to go to the next town, to the next town, to the next town for a longer journey, then that should be possible. And unfortunately, a lot of those drovers' routes you describe in places like the southwest we are now A-roads, or they actually sether communities, or they might be pretty country lanes, but you only need one person in a BMW being a bit of an arse, not looking at their directions sort of well enough to potentially get yourself into a particularly hairy moment. So I think something needs to be done, and that's partially about the maps. It's partially about using the maps to create attention, to create better paths, and it's also about shifting cultures so that people want to actually go and use those routes.
When did this idea come to you? Did it come out of lockdown, or had you had it before? And certainly lockdown kind of opened people's minds, didn't it, to... they could walk places where maybe they hadn't done before. So where did it come to you?
I've done a lot of walking. I've walked across all the national parks and all the cities in the UK. Actually, it's for a project where I was wearing a mind reading device that was measuring my emotions at the time. I have made films about land use in the country that's involved lots of walking. And I think when you do lots of walking, you begin to notice the things that are fantastic about the country and the things that are slightly limiting. And I think actually there's a lot of things in my background that led to the epiphany, if you like. But I do remember a journey between Salisbury and Winchester, and just thinking that there's all these routes that often like been used for hundreds of years that connect up these places, but many of them have these very elusive names. You know, it's like the Monarch's Way or the Pilgrim's Way or something. Yeah. So if you're kind of in the know and you've done your GCSE in geography and you've got your Duke of Edinburgh's award, then maybe you'll think to go and complete that journey. But where's the signage and the maps to invite you to do it? You know, so I just got thinking about that and got thinking about all the primary destinations we have around the country that both Department for Transport and Ordnance Survey have identified, and started thinking back to what the Romans were doing and what people were doing, you know, hundreds, thousands of years ago around these ideas, these straight routes between neighbouring places, and about how you could then create this geometric triangular network that would make it easier for people to imagine how to get from A to B.
Oh, but Dan, what did the Romans ever do for us?
Oh, what did the Romans ever do for us? Yeah. And so I spent about a year and a half actually trying to persuade various different outdoors organisations to support the idea, and everyone was saying, no, that's ridiculous, what are you talking about, kind of thing. Finally, just before lockdown, held an event, got some people together, we bashed around the idea, created about 1,000 routes. I thought lockdown was going to kill the whole project because people wouldn't be able to volunteer around the country. But actually what happened was, let's just get through this gate. But actually what happened was that there were very large numbers of people who love walking, who love maps, who were suddenly trapped indoors and isolated and wanted to connect with others. And about 700 people got trained up through Zoom, and these incredible, determined, creative individuals volunteered a year's worth of time in a single month, and created 100,000 kilometres of routes, 7,000 routes connecting 2,500 towns, cities and villages across the country. And that was then the foundation for the Slowways network.
And this was all put interactively online, right? On maps that on routes you can follow?
Yeah, so all the paths that we were using were public rights of way, and paths that we knew that you could definitely access using OS Maps, so Ordnance Survey's online mapping platform. And then we coordinated it through basically having very, very large Google spreadsheets, the biggest Google spreadsheets you can imagine, with lots of people collaborating to make sure we were covering off all those routes.
And what's the feedback you've received from the 700, from people who've been doing it? Have they been surprised by what they found? Have they been enthused, inspired? What do you think they've thought?
Well, I mean, there's the people who helped to create the initial routes, but the current phase of work is to say, right, we've got 100,000 kilometres of routes, but we've got a peer review process where we want at least three people to check every route. So to put that into context, that means walking at least 300,000 kilometres collectively, which actually the actual figure is very similar to collectively walking to the moon, is what we need to do to review all these routes, which is a big job. So currently there are thousands of people around the country who are walking and testing these routes, and also surveying them to show how accessible they are to people who might have particular sort of needs. That might be about the fact you're in a wheelchair, but it might also be you don't like cows very much and you want to avoid those cow fields.
Yes.
And
I've been in a cow field. Yeah. I've had to run to the top of it.
Yeah, I've had to run from cows before as well. So what people have found, I think, during that process, I think one of the big things is that people are discovering parts of the country to visit that they would never have normally have thought about visiting before. Because a lot of people's sort of geographic imaginations are kind of transfixed on the beacon that is Snowdon, you know. And so then you get hordes of people going to Snowdon, which has all its delights and all of its challenges as well. But in reality, many of us will know that you don't have to go far from Snowdon to have just as remarkable views, and you can have a whole valley and a whole mountain to yourself.
It's fascinating that you're talking about, you know, that half the world, it seems, went up Snowdon this summer and queued for, you know, an hour or so to do it. But essentially what Slowways is doing is actually, it seems to me, a little bit kind of enabling that kind of philosophy of guerrilla geography you're talking about, that it's not about going to one big space. It's about finding your own roots. It's about finding the genius, the beauty around you on your everyday.
Yeah, and you know, without a doubt, I think that some people will see Slowways and start thinking about going to places they would never have otherwise thought of going to before. And by the way, there isn't like the Slowways police out there making sure you stay on the route. If you want to like wander off and go a different way or just be inspired by the idea, then that's great. But I think another way that it sort of does something quite interesting in terms of geography is that, you know, you mentioned Snowdon, a lot of people going there. Well, that's about a recreational journey to one particular point, you know. And what Slowways do is they connect up neighbouring towns. And by doing that, they remember the purpose of why we have these routes originally, which was to get to a neighbouring place for trade or to go to church or to see family, whatever it might be. Because they remember about going to local towns, well, in a lot of local towns, you can sleep in like a Premier Inn for 29 quid. You can eat in Tesco for 3 quid, and then you can watch Netflix that night, which is a very different kind of journey, potentially, to thinking that you need to go and walk a national trail, which are fantastic. I'm not going to in any way get down on national trails. But they can be so long that they are technically difficult for people to complete. And then the range of accommodation along those journeys can also be at a price point that's inhibitive. But as well as that, like, well, what's the point of your journey? But if you're in Huddersfield and you want to get to Cardiff to see some family or friends or to work off the fact you've lost your job, then you can go on a journey which is at a lower price point but is more personal to you and opens up the country to you in a way which is very different to what everyone else is doing at the same time.
And what I like about Slowways is it's not about the idyll. It's very functional. I mean, we've walked a bit of a path today that was beautiful and quite muddy from walking by the river, by the mud banks. And then we moved into a pedestrian area that was more tarmacked. And now we're coming into kind of a residential and actually kind of on the outskirts of Exeter itself. And it's about kind of, it's about the philosophy of walking rather than the escape into nature.
And it's also about, well, what are your priorities? And I think that it's a big priority for people at the moment. Things are low cost and fast, right? Things that are low cost and fast quite often win out over quality. And actually the walk we're doing now, the train ride and the drive are both, I don't know, between 20 and 30 minutes. And it's just over an hour's walk. So it might take you, you know, a little bit longer, but then what do you get as a reward in return?
Some good conversation.
I've saved myself just over 3 quid on the train, which I can spend in the pub or a cafe instead. If I want to, I can save that. And not only the conversation, but I've managed to enjoy not just the nature, but the heritage and the culture, and a moment to reflect in a way that I would not have had on the train or if I'd driven.
That point of reflection is really important because, you know, in all the walking I've done, and it's lovely to walk with people, but it's also lovely to walk by yourself. They're two very different kind of sensibilities. It is that sense sometimes when you're walking that you get to reflect in a way that you don't when you're just caught up in the hustle and bustle. And I think kind of what happened over the last kind of 18 months has shown that. And maybe what Slowways can aspire to and is doing as well is opening people's minds for reflection and creativity as well.
I mean, I definitely know that I have my best ideas and I'm also best at processing things that have gone, you know, hard in my life or things that I need to work on when I'm out spending time on my own walking, without a doubt, or walking with someone who, you know, I really trust as well. And so then you think about the multiplier of that. I mean, people often talk about if we could get more people walking, the impacts on, you know, additional life expectancy or calories burnt then lead to, you know, people being less likely to get cancer, whatever it might be. And those are all true things. But at the same time, imagine how much more creativity we might have in the country if we had 10 times more walking and what that might that do as well for our collective imagination.
We had reached the outskirts of Exeter by now, and in the distance I could see the spire of the city's cathedral. We crossed the river by a road bridge and continued into Exeter, walking on a path through the wide floodplains on the west side of the river. As we walked, I asked Dan about the other major project he's helping drive. It's called National Park Cities.
I mean, obviously, Slowways is an immense project and it's taking up an enormous amount of your time. And I could imagine it could just kind of suck everything out of you that you need to do. But it's not the only project you're involved in. You're also involved in a really, really cool other project, National Park Cities. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, national park cities are super fun and I think really important. You know, when you look around the world, there are national parks, these special places where we have a better relationship with nature that represent every single major of internationally recognized habitat and landscape that you can imagine, from the deserts of Death Valley to obviously the great moorlands of the Cairngorms. But when you look at that family of national parks, they represent every single major type of habitat and landscape apart from one, which is urban areas. Now, to me, that feels a bit baffling. I understand historically why that's the case, because people have always seen urban nature as an urban people as being very separate from these national parks that need to be protected. But the reality is that I believe that urban nature, urban wildlife, is just as valuable as rural life. Where we are here in Exeter, the peregrine falcons that live on the church next to me are just as awesome as those that are in the Peak District or in Yosemite National Park. They just happen to be urban. And in London, where I started the campaign to make London a national park city, there are 15,000 species of wildlife, making it arguably one of the most biologically diverse and species-rich regions of the UK. And that abundance of life is exactly because of all the things that people have done in that city for hundreds, if not thousands of years, creating such a rich mosaic of different types of habitats and places across the city. And of course, London is home to about 9 million people who speak about 300 languages. I think those people are just as important and deserve a habitat that is as fulfilling and as enjoyable and as livable as people who live in any other national park or landscape around the world. And if we want to tackle many of the challenges we face in the cities, we desperately need to improve those habitats. We need clean air, we need clean water, we need safe environments for people to live in, and we need the people in those cities to be consuming the world's resources in more fair ways. So, you know, national parks, I think, are about big environments where we can enjoy ourselves and have a better relationship with nature. If we're not prejudiced against urban people and urban wildlife, then I don't think it makes any sense to exclude the right cities from that either.
That's fascinating, Dan. Now, I mean, we know kind of UN projections are that by 2050 that something like 75% of the world's population is going to be living in major urban areas and cities. So this sounds like just a really, really great idea. What's the criteria? What does it take to become a national park city? What does it look like?
Well, you know, when you look at the history of national parks around the world and great ideas like that, well, actually, a lot of them are allowed to just flourish and work things out for a long time. One of my colleagues, Alison Barnes, who's chief executive of the New Forest National Park, often describes this as, you know, inspiring, right? That you've got these great environments that some of our great writers and artists of the past went to these landscapes and were inspired by them. They probably weren't, like most of the public, bothered about the wiring and how you sort of create the criteria for how you designate one, or how it's managed on a day-to-day basis, or why Joe Bloggs wasn't allowed to build their conservatory, you know, whatever the thing might be going on. They're far more focused on being inspired by being in the Brecon Beacons or inspired by being in Pembrokeshire. But clearly, the wiring that actually protects those places are very important as well. So to become a national park city, there are 10 steps and 23 criteria for becoming a national park city. So with these 10 steps and 23 criteria, you know, it's not about there being a certain benchmark or threshold for example, the amount of green space you need to have, which is what people might expect, for example. Because actually, you know, a national park city in the desert in the US or in the Middle East maybe shouldn't even be green. And actually, there are some cities in the US which are green because they're golf courses, but they're in the desert and they really shouldn't be green. So just having simple criteria like that don't really work. We're far more interested in criteria that are about people in a city, policymakers, businesses, individuals working together to make the city greener, healthier, and wilder, to get more people more outdoors more of the time, enjoying and benefiting themselves by being outdoors, and about creating a new identity for that place that isn't just based on cities being political, cultural, and financial centres, but being ecological centres too. And so it's not so much about what you have been fortunate enough to inherit from previous generations. It's far more about, well, what are we doing in the city now so that future generations can live in a better environment in the future?
And do you think when you see that and you see cities and we look around and development and things, do you think we are being good ancestors, to use that phrase? Are we doing what maybe our kind of forebears used to do, is actually kind of planning ahead and thinking, or are we just living too much in the moment? And is that what National Park Cities is trying to achieve?
Well, let's be generous here. So when you say we, yeah, there are millions of us who are completely bang on trying to do the right things whenever we can and have the vision and the ideas and the practices and the relationships to do really great things in this world. But yeah, quite clearly the balance is wrong, and there's a larger we, which is currently destroying much of the planet, which is why, you know, we're facing another crisis we're in now. But what I find interesting is that if you were to go back a couple hundred years, we had ancestors, you know, in Wales and England and Scotland, across most of, you know, Western Europe, who were designing cities knowing that many of their interventions, whether it was creating new parks or planting trees, wouldn't come to fruition for 100, 200, maybe 300 years, which is why we have many of the great parks we now have in our urban environments. But you've got a question, like, well, what are we doing now that is equally as ambitious? When we build new extensions to cities and big sort of suburban estates, are we creating grand parks? Are we planting lines of fantastic oak trees that will be around a couple of years later? You know, what are we doing? And I'm not sure that we do have that same level of ambition that people had then. Equally, we're much better at other things as well, which is why our health is better and we're living longer and all those kinds of things. So if we could some of that kind of ambition for our urban environments with the knowledge and know-how we have now, I think our urban environments could be like extraordinarily better places to live, like within our lifetimes.
So why do we need these parks then? You know, just to play devil's advocate here, it's like, you know, some developers might say that the fabric of the city is the number of office buildings we put up. It's the revenue that we're going to get from the businesses that move in there. You know, from the idea of a national park city, what is the role of a park in the overall fabric and well-being of a city?
Well, the first thing to say is a national park city isn't about a park within a city. It's the entire urban conurbation and everything in it, right? So all the pigeons, all the grey space, all the green space, everyone's gardens,
even
private or public.
Even the pigeons?
Yeah, well, even the pigeons, all the grey space, all the green space, it's all included. And then you think about London, for example. London's a city where, you know, I think it's something like 1 in 7 children haven't played outdoors at all with their parents in the last year in a green space or an open environment. That has impacts on their physical weight, the mental health, their well-being, and so their creativity, their productivity, the ability to deliver for that city, as well as all those things that's so important for those individuals. There are hundreds of thousands of properties in London that are at risk of flooding, something which is only becoming worse with the climate emergency. There are about 10,000 people who die each year because of air pollution. I could go on and on and on. The point is that while we've made great strides in so many areas, ultimately, there are all these threats that our cities and urban environments face. But the strange thing is that in many of our urban environments, whether it's Exeter where I live or London or where you live in Cardiff, actually we have the people, the technology, the ideas and the solutions to tackle many of these challenges. But they're not being scaled up quickly or equitably enough across our cities. And a really good example of that might be the simple innovation of letting children play on streets or having trees on roads in poor parts of the city as well as wealthy parts of the city. And these are, you know, these ingenious technologies that have existed for a very long period of time. But the policies and the culture in cities are just slightly broken in terms of enabling that to happen. So I think what the National Park City can do is not only inspire some of those practices and help people join up to tackle some of those problems, but it also creates a very interesting tension where, because people's hopes and ambitions are increased for that space and they're aware of what's possible, that creates a tension that I think it makes it more likely that we see those solutions, you know, come true.
Isn't it? It's a little bit like the whole idea of reconnecting, restoring balance with nature. And in an urban environment, it's about making people invested in their own cities, that they're part of it, that they're embedded in the fluidity of life in them, not just human life, but kind of nature, but trees, environment, and how it all works together rather than it just being them in something and the city moves around them.
I think that's completely right. And you know, in that last question you were saying about, well, you know, what's in this for business? We've got to remember that businesses are made up of people and people with children. And those people in those businesses who have children also want their kids to have a nice city to live in. They want to have clean air, clean water, a nice environment to hang out in. And many of the, you know, most effective businesses in the world recognize that and know that if they want to have the best workforces that are healthier and more creative, then they need to have great environments to live in. And many of the leading property developers in London recognize that. And of course, now many of the office spaces are investing in things like green space and nature and those kinds of things, because it's what people are demanding. So we need to remember that on the demand side, like, very large numbers of people want to have a better relationship with nature. They just need to be enabled. And actually, I think there are some forces at the moment that get in the way of that. And a really good example is low traffic neighborhoods in many of our cities, where a minority of people who are being very loud on social media are preventing streets but becoming better for children to play on, better for cyclists, better for walkers, better for wildlife. And, you know, it's just not progressive at all. It's going in the wrong direction. But somehow we need to find the right kind of tension and vigor in our cities to say, look, guys, that's not the direction of travel. We want our streets to look like this instead.
Do you think we saw during the pandemic, Dan, that large numbers of people left major cities and have chosen to move into the countryside? Some of those people will come back. Do you think that the philosophical change after the pandemic will be a spur for building better in the future in cities?
Yeah, I very much hope so. I think that you know, never mind COVID as an emergency, climate as an emergency would tell me, and based on my sort of working knowledge, that actually it's far more effective in terms of the distribution of resources, things like health and social care, if people are closer together. But those people who are closer together need to have better quality environment to live in. So part of the reason why people were leaving the city was partially because the city was not being effective enough at keeping them, because the lived environment wasn't good enough. And maybe if we had far better cities to live in, then that wouldn't have happened so much. People wouldn't have felt the need to leave the city.
So, Dan, we finished our walk, and we walked up the X, and we're now sitting in the rather picturesque harbour of Exeter. There are people enjoying the sunshine. There's a few people kind of in kayaks. There's swans swallowing around. And I just wanted to ask at the end of this walk, you know, you've talked eloquently today and really inspiringly about kind of slow ways and also about national park cities. And I wondered if this kind of, what's the big picture? What is something draw them all together? I mean, where does it go in the future?
Well, like in a very simple visual way, I guess, maybe in the future, your city, Cardiff, and London and Glasgow and Newcastle and Southampton and many cities will be national park cities, and they'll be physically connected by slow ways, maybe. That was never the intention with setting up the two projects, but I quite like that idea. But I think the bigger connection really is that I think that many of us are very anxious at the moment about, you know, the climate change and the sort of state of the world, really. I think it's very easy in that anxious place to be very concerned about many of the problems we face and feel like there's not much we can really do about them. I think certainly the politics of our time often makes us feel that there's not much we can do about those issues. And I think what both these ideas give me, and hopefully give others, are positive stories, positive visions, positive ideas for the future, which, although they might seem quite grand, the idea of a national network of walking routes or national park cities, at the end of the day, both the ideas are really about walking more, spending more time together, being a bit more local, a bit more soft on the land, that being a bit kinder to nature. And ultimately, if we do these things simply in our everyday lives, but knowing how they connect to others, I think we can make quite significant traction on those bigger things that feel sometimes a bit overwhelming. So at a time when there's a lot of negativity, hopefully, you know, the positivity of these ideas will help a lot of people.
Dan, those sentiments are very, very close to my heart and to the Liminal Forest as well. Dan Raven Ellison, thank you so much for going on a walk with me today.
Thank you for walking a slow way with me.